This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
If any of you guys want to go for breakfast tomorrow, maybe we can get a little breakfast together.
I'll let you. Yeah. I don't know.
It is Monday, which means it's time for the Front Three Weekend Review with me, Adam Bolt, with the one and only Lawrence McKenna.
Welcome. Welcome.
Lovely stuff. And of course, Chris Hennage.
Good evening.
Chris, funnily enough, is sitting.
You guys are just sat in the same room.
Chris is sitting not even 6 foot away from me right now, recording on a separate laptop. We're sort of muting ourselves as we sit very close together. It's a very weird situation. We haven't. What are we doing, Chris? What's going on right now?
What do you mean? I'm staying at yours.
I mean, it just feels. It feels slightly nonsensical that we're both recording on separate laptops with separate microphones, but we don't have the technological knowledge to do it any other way. It just doesn't feel right, you know?
Yes, I will agree with that.
Succinct. I like it. Yes, that's right. Chris Hennage is literally sleeping on my sofa tonight. It's a beautiful thing.
It's just weird that you're spooning him.
This is the perfect podcast recording conditions in many ways. Usually we're... How far away is Newcastle from... or Durham, I should say, from London, Chris, usually?
Probably 300 miles, I think.
Yeah, now just 3 feet separating us. It's a beautiful thing. But enough of this loving, guys. There is a podcast to get on with. There's a lot of football this weekend. There's only one place to start, Lawrence, and that is with tonight's very, very exciting and meaningful game between Chelsea and Watford. It ended 4-3, somewhat unbelievably. Chelsea conceding 3 goals, I believe, for the first time this season, if I'm not mistaken. John Terry scoring a goal, messing up for another goal. A game packed with incident, Lawrence, and much excitement.
Yeah, very exciting game, actually. I mean, a great way to cap off a championship, I suppose. John Terry obviously gets his goal, his farewell goal at Stamford Bridge. It seemed like a really good sort of ending match, something to remind Chelsea fans that actually they're not as powerful, I think, as they think their team are. But at the same time, they can still flex their muscle.
They made a lot of changes. Conte made a few changes. He's got some young players in there.
Give all of those guys. I think what he was trying to show was that this isn't only a Chelsea team for now, but also a Chelsea team for the future and a team that he feels confident in. You know, he's got the old guard of John Terry on the pitch. At the same time, he's got the young guys who can also carry out the system. I think there's Conte still realizes he has a long way to go with this side. People were talking about him leaving a little bit earlier, maybe to unsettle him, maybe to unsettle this Chelsea team. But right now, he seems very happy where he is. And I wouldn't be surprised if we see him for a couple more seasons set up this as a dynasty side and leave them with a bit of a legacy that, in the same way as Juve have now.
Chris, whilst we were spooning earlier watching Monday Night Football, something I heard Gary Neville say just didn't sound right to me. Chris, he was talking about Cesar Azpilicueta, obviously a tremendous defender, obviously scored a fantastic goal himself tonight. Billed somewhat as the unsung hero, but Gary Neville saying he's the best defender in the league, Chris. And to me, that just sounds wrong. Would you agree?
I think unsung hero is a fair tag. I don't believe best defender in the Premier League is. I think you can certainly give him credit for adapting from a fullback to a centre-back, because that's a very different role. You've got a lot more responsibility, even in a three-man back-line system. I still think there are better centre-backs. So if I was building a squad tomorrow based on Premier League players, I don't think he would be my first pick at centre-back. That's not to say that he wouldn't make the squad, but I don't think he's the standalone best.
Who is the best defender in the Premier League then, Chris?
I'm inclined to say that it's probably Vertonghen or Alderweireld. If I was building my team tomorrow, I would want one of the Belgians at Spurs.
Is that just because you're staying around my house and you're within 3 feet of me? You're buttering me up by saying the Spurs centre back pairing are the best in the Premier League.
No, I say that knowing full well that I was fortunate enough to get this bet.
That is fair enough. Lawrence, who in your opinion is the best centre-back in Premier League? Because as good as Piliquet is, I just think that was kind of a strange
thing. Staying at yours, right?
Yeah, I mean, we'll see how it goes. We'll see how many more Spurs players he compliments tonight. Okay. But for now, he's just staying around on the sofa. He may be upgraded to the bed. You know, the girlfriend might get downgraded. You know, we'll see how things play out. But as for yourself, Lawrence, who is the best defender in the Premier League in your humble opinion?
It's a really good question. I mean, I probably could go for a Spurs player right now.
Young
centre back?
No, just full stop. Period, as the Americans say.
Well, I was going to go young centre back. I'm going to go. Stop cutting me off. Young centre back. I'm going to go Eric Bailly, and older centre back. I'm going to have to go
with Toby. No?
You know what? Yeah, it's hard to look beyond the. It's hard to look beyond Big Tobes.
We all love a Big Tobes. Toby had a vote in Yamatong, and I think they have been exceptional this season. Incredibly consistent. Best defence in the league, I believe, for Spurs once again.
You know, they were the only team to win all six of their Premier League games during April.
It's a sensational statistic. It's almost as if Statman Dave is here in spirit in many ways. Let's talk about Tottenham, Manchester United without him. So he has no way to defend his own team. What an occasion, Lawrence. Not just me saying it. Many young four-year-olds have been saying that as well. It was a wonderful occasion for Tottenham. You know, I was there. I was lucky enough to get myself a ticket, a very expensive ticket. There's no need to divulge how much. But I got myself into the ground. And I've got to say, what an atmosphere. What a fantastic day. Lots of the songs being sung, all of the legends being serenaded throughout the game. It's sort of a fun little game almost to see.
Which legends?
Well, you know, the songs were coming out throughout the game. Rafael van der Vaart, you know, the songs about Ricky Villa, the songs about all these sort of classic Spurs players throughout the game. It was a nice sort of touch, I think, by the Spurs fans to almost pay tribute to those legends, even before they came out on the pitch after the game. It almost felt in a way that the result was second to the occasion. I think for many people it was almost a foregone conclusion that Spurs were going to win. Manchester United sort of threatened to make it a game somewhat towards the end after Rooney scored late on. But I think the result was always comfortable in many ways. I think it was just a fantastic occasion. I think the club did well to put on a real show. I know you know, there was some unruly types invading the pitch after the final whistle, something that I would never do, and there's no photographic evidence to suggest otherwise. But at the same time, you can't blame those fans. You know, this is their club, this is their stadium. It was the last ever game at White Hart Lane, even though, yes, the new stadium's, what, 160 feet away, if that. I think it was a bittersweet occasion in many ways, I think, Lawrence, because although it was a sad day to farewell to White Hart Lane, and there was this beautiful sort of film, I'd say, after the game, Kenneth Branagh, the famous Spurs fan, sort of narrating the history of White Hart Lane. I think that was fantastic to celebrate. We had all the legends coming out on the pitch. I mean, some of the legends were more arguable than others. There was Ledley King, of course. He's only got one knee. He's better than John Terry. There was Peter Crouch, who, of course, scored the goal that secured Spurs' first ever season in the Champions League. It was great to see him there. Robbie Keane, Ricky Villa, the Argentinian legend, alongside his teammate, both nationally and for Spurs, Ozzie Ardiles. Justin Edinburgh, someone who's maybe a bit more questionable. Stephen Carr as well, paraded as a legend. Not so sure about those ones. But David Ginola, my own personal hero coming out. Fantastic to see him there. I think it was a great sort of show. Spurs came on a great tribute to the history of both the stadium, to the club, and some of the great players that have played at this stadium. But at the same time, there was an optimism about looking to the future, looking forward to that new stadium that, you know, for many Spurs fans, I think the best days are yet to come for Tottenham Hotspur. A lot of excitement, a lot of optimism about that new stadium, about Pochettino staying at the club, about this young, promising squad that are there as well. So I think it was a fantastic day and a perfect way to wrap up the season unbeaten. I think for the first time since 1966, I think, unbeaten at home in the league. It got a free flag as well, Lawrence. You can't argue with that, you know. A free T-shirt, that was nice. I think, you know, a lot of the talk turns towards, you know, next season. I think it's easy for a lot of fans to snipe about, oh, how Spurs haven't won anything. You know, they won the putting on the pressure trophy, I think some people called it. They won the finishing above Arsenal trophy. I think it's easy to belittle Spurs, but when you look at the expectations at the start of the season, when you look at the way many people projected them to maybe struggle to finish in the top four, I think it's been a fantastic achievement for Spurs to finish second now, to finish above Arsenal. You know, easy for other fans to try and, you know, use that as almost a stick to beat Spurs with. But I think it's a fantastic achievement nonetheless. Wouldn't you agree, Chris Hennage, sitting just a few feet away from me, that it's been a fantastic season for Spurs?
It has, because it's felt like progression. That's the key thing. It's very easy to quantify things in trophies. I think for Spurs at this precise moment, there is a feeling of a project being undertaken, not just in terms of getting them up the league and getting them into the Champions League, but I think actually building a squad that could mount a challenge, so that there is no sort of ambiguity about, you know, did they let it slip or what have you, so that they're the ones on top and they're essentially asking the rest of the pack to chase them rather than doing the chasing themselves.
I think in many ways it was Spurs who made this a title challenge this season. I think we all expected Manchester City to be fighting for the Premier League title. We all expected Manchester United maybe to be up there. But Spurs, I think, were the one team who, albeit having a patchy sort of first half to the season, putting together that incredible run after Christmas, putting together those 9 wins in a row, they sort of transformed this into a title challenge in the end, Chris. I think a lot of people now are already looking to next season. I mean, for you, what do Spurs need to do next season to continue this project and continue this optimism, continue this momentum almost? Do you think it's important for them to actually win silverware? Because, you know, as a Spurs fan myself, I think next year is crucial. It could potentially be a very, almost a defining season for Pochettino and for this side. They've been together now for 2 seasons. The likes of Dele Alli and Harry Kane have proved themselves on this stage with their consistency over the course of back-to-back seasons. Eric Dier as well. I think the whole squad's sort of coming together in a way. The whole project is coming together. Next season presents its own challenges, of course. Wembley being the home stadium for Spurs. Do you think if things don't continue on the upwards trajectory, Spurs being of the status it is, perhaps not one of the elite clubs in England, although, you know, almost a burgeoning status in that respect, that if they don't achieve silverware, if they don't achieve progress, that, you know, there is the danger, there is the risk that the likes of Dele Alli, the likes of maybe even Mauricio Pochettino could look elsewhere to fulfil their ambitions at the end of next season?
Possibly. I think what Spurs have to do, yes, winning something will be an important milestone for them. Whether it's an FA Cup or a League Cup even, it is, as long as this team wins something, then it can start to really push forward, I think, at least from a mental perspective. In terms of what they have to do actually as a team, as a football club, I think firstly they have to become shrewder with their big money investments. You look at the likes of Soldado and I feel bad for saying him, but Lamela to a certain degree, and then obviously Sissoko as well. they've not been able to give consistent value for money. I think that's the problem, because Lamella has been a game changer at points, but again, it's not been that consistency. Unfortunately, he's had that nasty injury this season. So when it comes to making those high ticket purchases, I think they do need to become a little bit shrewder there. I'd also like to see some of the young players start to be integrated into this. You look at Marcus Edwards as a good example, Keenan Bennett, who's in the under-18s, maybe putting him onto a pathway so he can either go out on loan or something like that. There's been a few these last few years. I look at Cameron Carter-Vickers, who got a start in the FA Cup, Alex Pritchard. More so with Pritchard, I think that kind of player, it's been difficult for Spurs because they've been so desperate to move up the league and achieve something. They necessarily can't take a risk, I would imagine they'd argue, with someone like Pritchard. And I think that's where perhaps they have to show just a little bit of courage and throw someone like that in.
I think that's a very good point you make. I think it's definitely going to be a balance of those two factors almost. I think definitely with the new stadium coming in, with potential handbrakes almost on Spurs' financial muscle, bringing through those young players, as Pochettino has shown he can do, is something they're going to have to continue to prove. And definitely, as you say, those big money signings, Spurs don't have a great record of spending their money wisely. I think it's been so hit or miss the past few seasons for every Victor Wanyama, who I think has been a fantastic signing this season. As you mentioned there is a Moussa Sissoko, who is, it still beggars belief, the most expensive signing in Tottenham Hotspur's history. Eric Lamela, I think, you know, he was one of the best players for Spurs last season. It's very disappointing, almost surprising that, you know, we've coped so well without him, because he was so vital to the way Pochettino wanted his side to play last season, with his pressing, with his aggression, his intensity in pressuring opponents. Janssen, again, hasn't really done the job that he was brought in to do. So I think if this summer we can sort of, we definitely need to bring in players who are going to strengthen that squad, who are going to improve our depth, improve our options from the bench, certainly. Provide other options to break down stubborn teams who are potentially going to approach us in a more cautious light next season. I think that is going to be key. You know, Wilfried Zaha is someone I think would be a great signing. But as Dave mentioned before, yeah, I knew you were going to jump at that point. You know, it depends how much his price tag is, Dave. But perfect time for you to come in. We've been talking about Spurs and what a fantastic occasion it was for them. The perfect way to send off White Hart Lane and to look towards the future. As for Manchester United, do you think it's harsh to say that Jose Mourinho threw this game once again, as he was accused of doing against Arsenal? What I'd say, though, is when I saw that lineup, when it was announced, I felt very confident the Spurs were going to win this game. Mm-hmm. As I had before the game, it wasn't a lineup that I ever felt threatened the perfect send-off to White Hart Lane.
No, I think I kind of agree with that. I think it's like a mixture of a team that's got youth in it, but then it's got players like Wayne Rooney and Michael Carrick that just shouldn't be at the football club anymore. That in terms of a progressive United team under Mourinho, shouldn't be there. They're just not good enough. You know, Wayne Rooney in the last two games against Arsenal and Spurs put in 13 tackles and not even won a single one. Absolutely atrocious. You know, the likes of Mourinho's tactics as well, going to Nzebi and Michael Carrick, Manmark and Dele Alli and Christian Eriksen, just didn't work. You know, Spurs were playing a 4-2-3-1, United were playing a 4-2-3-1. So why did Mourinho get his two defensive midfielders to pick up their, you know, Spurs' right winger and their attacking mid? Doesn't that open up space for Wanyama, open up space for Son, which it did? It just seemed a bit weird for Mourinho, it really did. It seemed like he, as well as the players, he didn't really care. And it was kind of like just for players like Anthony Martial to come out and see what they could do.
Obviously, all the eggs are in the Europa League basket, as we mentioned on this podcast last week. But something that I said to Stephen Housen earlier today, I was on the Warm Down show he's got on his channel. Do go and check it out, shameless plug. But I sort of almost mentioned that I felt like it was something that you wouldn't have expected in a million years from Manchester United or even Jose Mourinho to sort of field a team like this, to field a side that felt so weak. And as you say, given the impression that he doesn't really care about a game, be it against a Spurs team who finished in second, be it against, you know, with Manchester United almost not certain to finish outside top four. I know that was confirmed after the game. But almost that he'd almost given up in a sense.
The big thing with them that frustrated me personally was they didn't experiment with anything. Like the lineup looked like it could have been a 3-4-3, playing two and Xavi maybe as a right wing back, maybe as a right centre back. And it did. It wasn't that. It was a 4-2-3-1. It was very basic. It was how United have been playing all season in these big games and been struggling. You know, a 4-4-2 diamond that we touched on against Manchester City at the start of the game. Mkhitaryan as a 10, Martial and Rashford as the two strikers. These things, he needs to start to play around with it. And why not do it now? Like, why are you messing about? Why are you playing Michael Carrick? Why are you playing Wayne Rooney? You might as well not. You know, if you know that this is it, it's done. Like, you might as well experiment. You know, I've been super supportive of Mourinho this season. He's a fantastic manager. But there's times now where he might as well just go, why don't we just try this? Why don't we try that? Why don't we see what we can do here? Is a back three going to work? You know, what Chelsea done? They won the Premier League. Or they played a 3-4-3. Why don't we try that? Why don't we, you know, work for that for a few games? Maybe try that. You know, there's a lot of things Mourinho could do tactically. And until Herrera and Mkhitaryan were brought on, United were awful. Absolutely awful. The game changed, and arguably, you know, you think of the Eric Bailly chance that for some reason he played a backward pass when he was clean for one goal. And obviously the Rooney goal, that makes it 2-2. Spurs didn't quite kill the game, and they never killed the game. But, you know, an old United team, or a Ferguson United team, should we say, would have drawn that 2-2, or would have even won 3-2. This team lacks a bit of that gusto. It lacks a bit of that just pure determination and ability to sort of fight adversity in a way and come back.
I thought what was actually really interesting, you know, having sort of regarded Manchester United in a historical sense as the most successful club in England, the club to be feared, it was interesting to see the contrast almost between a Spurs team, as I've said, who there's a real optimism around this side, around this club, around this manager of the long-term project that, you know, for a number of years now, I think there's a real plan in place and there's a real bright future, essentially, for this team. Looking at Manchester United, on the other hand, as you said, there's players there who potentially shouldn't be at the club. There's this really disjointed feel about the squad and maybe the club as a whole. I mean, how do you feel with respect to this season? You know, it's still up in the air whether Manchester United will secure qualification for the Champions League. How do you feel about the long-term future of Manchester United? Because obviously Jose Mourinho's a manager who historically hasn't stayed at a club long-term. We're thinking maybe there's another 2-3 seasons in him at Manchester United. How do you feel about the long-term picture at this club?
Long-term picture is fine. I think, you know, you mentioned the young players. Spurs of Man United have got some young players in there. Anthony Martial, Marcus Rashford, Tuan Zebi, Fosu Mensah. The list goes on. There's a lot of players that are breaking through at the moment. Joel Pereira, obviously, in goal. And there's a lot of lads in there that could really, really, you know, do something at this football club. I'm not worried at all. I think in terms of Mourinho, it's going to be interesting to see next season. I mentioned before his attack and intent and how he organises his attackers. That needs to be massive work on that in the summer. Massive, massive work. Need to get rid of the Louis van Gaals. Too many backwards passes. Need to be positive on the football. And that's something Mourinho needs to do as a coach. And that's something he needs to... If he doesn't do that, then he won't stay at United for longer than 3 years. If he does do that, then he will be at United for 10 years. This is the big thing. It's Mourinho evolving and adapting like Ferguson did before him. And if he can't do it, then he won't get far. But if he can do it, he will get far. And it's as simple as that. If he develops United in an attacking sense, they'll go big. You know, Anthony Martial played 6 games this season and then you know, last season was 26 full games. One of these things where give your players a bit of trust. And it goes back to that. It's trusting in these young players. Because United have got a lot of talented young lads. If you sign someone like Antoine Griezmann, still 26, talented young player. You know what I mean? Like, not at the peak yet. Not a Cristiano Ronaldo, Lionel Messi level. Can get there. And it's all about the development, I think, at the moment for Manchester United. But talking about development, Jurgen Klopp, diamond.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Failed at it?
Wow, that was such a good transition, Dave. You read my mind. It's almost like you knew I was about to come to Liverpool, which is where we bring Lawrence McKenna back in. just a week after their stumble against Southampton, Lawrence, they go to the London Stadium and Liverpool hammer West Ham 4-0, potentially cementing their place in the top four, potentially cementing Champions League football next season. What did you make of this performance?
Well, actually, I think Liverpool still have a lot of time to surprise West Ham, probably. I think he moved Coutinho into a slightly different space, more centrally, obviously. But he could still cut in onto his more powerful foot or his more dangerous foot. And then I also think he played Sturridge just the right time. I also think, though, Liverpool have done very well away from home this season. You know, it's not always been the same story at home. You know, we go back to Anfield, I think the pressure comes on. I think Liverpool get very nervous. And I think that's where, when Liverpool need to finish their season there, they're going to have to prove that under the pressure moments, it's not just, you know, the Champions League nights when games, and when they finish the season, they want to get 3 points. They can't afford anything less, really, because of the status of Arsenal. And I think, you know, as much as we're praising a lot of what Liverpool have done, there's still some huge gaping deficiencies in that side that Liverpool need to plug.
Typical negative Lawrence.
It's not negative, it's just sort of realistic, isn't it?
That diamond, Lawrence, though, was beautiful.
I mean, yeah, Dave, the diamond's good.
It's like the days of, you know, Brendan Rodgers in a way, where he had Sterling at the tip, Coutinho was playing top of left central midfield, and then they had two strikers. Obviously, Sturridge and Firmino now, and Lallana is a 10, but it's quite interesting how similar it is. Do you think this is something that Jurgen Klopp can do, Lawrence, to sort of take this Liverpool side further, is play this diamond system against these weaker sides?
I think initially, yes. I think later on, he's going to, again, struggle to unlock other sides. I think if people work out what Liverpool are doing, it's actually quite straightforward. There needs to be some more to Liverpool.
Wow, his connection is bad. Dave, I mean, Slaven Bilic came out after the game, said it had been a very difficult...
Said it wasn't his fault. It was Sam Allardyce's fault.
He said it was a difficult season, is how he actually phrased it. We all know you are part of the Slaven Bilic fan club. If you took off your bias hat for 1 second,
yes.
Dave...
One goddamn second.
How would you assess this season? I mean, mid-table finish, essentially, 12th, 11th place finish, depending on how they get on against Burnley in the next fixture. Given that it was such a difficult start to season, given the new stadium, that almost intangible issue that came up, I mean, it's not been the worst season, has it, for Slaven Bilic?
It's been pretty rotten, to be quite honest. You know, he's been
on two
different spells of losing four games or more. And the thing with Bilic, to defend him, he's been a little bit unlucky in terms of his... you know, main goal-scoring threat. Michael Antonio has been out injured for the last few months. Dimitri Payet obviously went in January, who was their biggest chance credit over the last two seasons by a country mile, and still like top three in the Premier League. So there is no big impact that they've lost. But again, I can't really defend Bilic. I think he's rudimental. I think that there's managers that are 20 times better than he is in the Premier League, and he's struggled this year. He really has struggled. And there's been times where they've been absolutely atrocious. I think of the last time where, you know, they didn't win in like, you know, seven games. Before that, they didn't win six games, and they went on to like beat Burnley 1-0. Then they beat Hull 1-0. Small margins, tiny margins. That game goes slightly different. They hit the post instead of scoring. You know, it changes. They get relegated. And unfortunately, you don't want a manager to have longevity in the Premier League. You don't want managers to be like that, where it's literally that cutthroat. They are coming out of games winning 1-0. Big, big games in the season. So I think it's one of these things where you need to take a little bit of Tony Pulis, understand what Tony Pulis does with set pieces, with corners. Take some of that. Go back to Big Sam. What does Big Sam do in a defensive sense? Take that on board. And then you've got the likes of Michelantonio and Landini. Landini's been fantastic the last few months. Absolutely brilliant. Take those two players and build your team around Michelantonio and Landini, and you might have a chance of getting the Europa League. But if you don't do the basics of scoring set pieces and defending well, you've got nothing in the Premier League.
It's very
That's
true.
Bread and butter.
It's very true. Speaking of which, let's move on to Manchester City, Chris. A 2-1 win for them over Leicester this weekend as they continue to push for a top four finish. Looks like it's going to happen now. They've got a game in hand, of course, now on Liverpool, so they could indeed finish third. Interestingly, Pep Guardiola coming out after the game saying, you know, he would have been sacked by his former clubs, Barcelona and Bayern Munich, if he had ended the season without a trophy, as City have failed to do this season.
Small club, yeah.
I mean, is that a fair assessment, do you think, Chris, of his own sort of time at the club? Because, you know, being at the end of the season, at the start of this campaign, we were expecting Guardiola to not walk this league, but to do better than he has. I mean, those 10 wins in a row were so impressive. All the talk was, you know, that they were going to easily win the Premier League. As it's turned out, Guardiola's record has been questioned. His managerial skills have been questioned. I mean, how are we viewing his first season at Manchester City with, I think it's fair to say, a number of mistakes made by the manager himself?
I think, realistically, you have to try and find a middle ground in so much as, undeniably, he has underperformed. I think he set a frighteningly high standard for himself with his previous jobs, and then he was, I think, slightly with Bayern, I would say less so with Barcelona. He was fortunate that he arrived at a club at a very good time for what he wanted to do and what he wanted to achieve. I think City this season, if we go back to the summer, that is a squad that was in heavy transition in so much as it was right at the end of its life cycle. And so you look at players like Sanya, Clichy, even Zabaleta to a degree. You're asking players who are near the end of their careers to make a significant adaptation in the way that they play football. That's a big ask. You then look at the sort of end of this season and you've got Yaya Touré back in the team, who last season we were talking about, I remember even writing about him being a player that had no future under Guardiola, not just because they didn't get on, but also because he just did not fit the style. I mean, this was a coach that sold him at Barcelona, so there was little, if anything, to suggest he would keep him around thereafter. And I think, you know, that's perhaps where you criticise Guardiola and say that his methods clearly aren't very adaptable. They work to the certain calibre of player that I think he's used to working with. And I think equally his club will have to take blame, because I don't think they set him up to succeed. I think actually they really gave him the chance to maybe at a push bring in a few players that could change things and help them, but not enough to do what he wanted to do. And in, I would say, in certain ways, Man City have, once again, I think, signed or brought in a player or a manager in this case that they weren't really ready to initiate, and they weren't really ready to switch over with. It just points to a chronic lack of planning for me.
I think that's fair in a way. I think the conditions they inherited, I mean, I know Stephen Allison, for one, would disagree with that sentiment entirely. Dave, what are you saying? How are we judging Pep Guardiola's first season in the Premier League? Because although I agree with Chris to an extent that, you know, the foundations that were there were not ideal, he's what's the phrase? Dug his own grave in many ways. He's been hammering the nails in his own coffin, even though he's not dead in a metaphorical sense. I'm mixing them up there. But you know what I mean? He's not helped himself in some regards.
I think he hasn't, hasn't he? I think tactically he's tried a bit too much in the Premier League. He's quite a robust league. He's not become pragmatic, which potentially he should do. I like his methodology in terms of what he wants to do with the front sort of five attackers sort of going down the line of, you know, going back to the WM system that Pochettino plays so well at Tottenham. I think that's the difference, that Pochettino's had time with this Tottenham side. And if you give Guardiola that same amount of time, City are going to be absolutely disgustingly good going forward as well as defensively. I think it's a lot of time, and I agree with Chris, the signings have been atrocious, the squad that City built, knowing that Guardiola's there, that's not the most frustrating thing for City fans, but the stupidest thing for City fans, that the board have known that they're going to get Guardiola in, and they've proceeded not to get good fullbacks and whatever. You know, I've said this 30,000 times, but it just seems to be the same problems, and, you know, beating Leicester on Saturday is just another win on the way to something. Right, Gabriel Jesus, of course, is going to be a big player for them. They kind of need to lose Aguero. They need to get rid of Aguero. They need to build this side around Sterling, Sane and Gabriel Jesus. That's the perfect front three for them. Great podcast. But apart from that, there is work to be done. There's definite work to be done for Guardiola. I want to see him. I want to see what Guardiola... I'm so excited about what Guardiola does. You know, he's going to... Next season, right, we're going to start the Premier League and we're like, oh, Guardiola's played a 4-3-3. No, it's not. He'll play something crazy. I reckon it's going to be like some sort of 3-5-2 hybrid with a 4-4-2 mixed with a 7-3-1 with a sweeper.
I agree that I think next season it's almost going to be defining for Guardiola. I think we'll see a much improved Manchester City team. I'm excited to see what he does with this side next season with another summer under his belt, with more time on the training ground as well. But as for this season, I mean, Dave, again, what do you make of what many see as the biggest mistake he made this season? Not necessarily letting Joe Hart go to Torino on loan, but bringing in Claudio Bravo, who I think it's fair to say is underwhelmed at the very least.
I don't think that's his biggest mistake. I don't think that's a. I think that's a weird situation where a keeper that's the top of his game, that's just been part of a squad that's won the Champions League, that's won the treble, to drop down to have a, you know, a shot save percentage of as bad as Claudio Bravo's this season. I don't think that's an error. I think his error was in the transfer market and not assessing his squad quick enough. Something that he's not had to do before, because, you know, given at Barcelona, he knew the guys there. Bayern Munich were a great side. He's never had to deal with a bit of a dodgy squad. And to evaluate quickly what he needs. And that'll be, you know, a test of him this summer to see whether he can evaluate what he's got. And I think that's his biggest problem at the moment, is not being able to evaluate things quick enough and giving it to someone like, you know, Jesus Navas, another 3-year deal or whatever for a player that's been redundant for Manchester City for an X amount of time. Sort of like your Wayne Rooney's, like your Michael Carrick's Manchester United. It's a real weird one, and I think Guardiola needs to sort that out, be a little bit more cutthroat, should you say, with players that aren't quite at the standard. Don't think he can coach everyone. But at the same time, Joe Hart, weird one letting him go.
I mean, he hasn't exactly impressed at Torino, but it's a fascinating situation nonetheless. Anyway, look, guys, let's move on to Swansea beating Sunderland at the Stadium of Light 2-0 this weekend to secure their Premier League status, with Hull failing to win their own game against Crystal Palace. Lawrence, our own friend of the show, of course, Bob Bradley, making way for Paul Clement. Earlier this year, but he has secured Premier League status for the Swans. I mean, how impressed have you been with him, and how surprised are we? Because I think just a few weeks back, with Hull in the ascendancy, with Hull on form, we were all pinning Marco Silverstein to be the one who were going to stay up.
Yeah, I mean, they don't miss out by a lot. I also think that a lot of people backed Marco Silva because see him overcome the adversity which was there, and I think a lot of people, us included, thought that he had shown a lot of English managers or the managers that had gone previously to be not deficient, but maybe less tactically. Yeah, at the end, I think it's going to be very, very close. And I think, you know, 6 points, they say one game counts as 6 points. I think the same is going to count come the end of the season. It's a lot narrower, I think. I think at the same time, Hull also had a lot more ground to make up, not only points wise, but in terms of where they were within their season and how progressed they were as a side. I think it was to bringing things together at Swansea, where it was actually shaping a squad at Hull. I think either way, there have been some great jobs done. It's just that they're very different jobs at both clubs.
It's fine margins, isn't it, Dave? And you can't help but feel in the last few weeks, that's where Hull have lost it. Of course, losing at home to Sunderland last week, it almost felt like the final now in the coffin. What do you think's next for Hull? Now relegation's been confirmed. Do you think Marco Silva, as we've been saying for a number of weeks now, could potentially be on his way to another job, be it elsewhere in the Premier League?
I think he's got to be elsewhere, right? Marco Silva's far too good for Hull City. The work that he did in that short period of time was pretty incredible. If Hull City can hold him up and, you know, can... he'll be able to get them promoted in the Championship. I think he's too good a manager not to do that. So I think it's all about Hull, what they want as a club, whether they can afford to keep him, whether, you know, he wants to be there, you know, give him something that can keep him there. It's one of these big things in football. But again, if I were Marco Silva, I'd be looking to get a big job out there, you know, looking at the likes of Borussia Dortmund, given Thomas Tuchel's potential plight at the club with the fallout of the board. If Lucien Favre doesn't go in there, maybe look at that job. But, you know, there's a lot of places he could go. Seems, again, with England, with all the rubbish that when he came over, oh, he's, you know, he's foreign, all that crap. You know, we don't deserve him in the Premier League. We don't deserve his quality of manager, and he should go elsewhere.
How do we not deserve him?
I just feel like sort of the, it's kind of like what's going on with England with the Merson comments, that he's a foreigner, you know, he's not done anything, I could win the league with Olympiacos. It's that righteousness in a way.
Don't you think your comments like balance that out though?
Yeah, I do and I don't. I just
many people have feel agreed for someone like Marcus. I don't know that many people who really agree with us.
I know, but it's kind of like one of these things where we on this podcast don't agree with that 100%. But
I think in a way we're almost in our, I don't want to say our little bubble in a way, but
I kind of feel that.
I'd almost say like the majority of people would have had that opinion about, I think the majority of people would have had that opinion about Marco Silva when he joined the club.
I don't know, man.
I think he's changed.
I don't think that makes people less informed. And I think Marco Silva is trying to, you know, having a manager like Marco Silva shows what can be achieved, and I think he's vital to English football, and having managers like that is important to English football. To demonstrate what's out there, because I think it proves that there isn't English arrogance everywhere. I think that there are just a very select few that are arrogant, or maybe not even arrogant, ignorant.
Let's move on. A few more fixtures to wrap up. We won't stay too long on Bournemouth winning 2-1 at home against Burnley. We also had Southampton winning 2-1 away at Middlesbrough. The other fixture of note this weekend was Stoke losing 4-1 to Arsenal at the Britannia Stadium. I don't want to focus too much on Arsenal because I think we're going to have a lot to say about them next week if it is indeed confirmed they finish outside the top four for the first time in Arsene Wenger's tenure at the club. But I do want to talk a little bit about Stoke, Chris, because this is a team we were saying a few weeks ago, you know, they finished ninth three seasons in a row. We were talking about how potentially that's something that's going to happen again, whether that's almost a mark of consistency for Mark Hughes, whether, you know, there's a sign that they need to evolve, they need to move to another level on this manager. There is a lot of discontent now among Stoke fans. Another defeat for them. It's now only one win in the last 10 league games. The season really is petering out with a whimper. And the defeat means they are going to finish in the bottom half of the table for the first time since 2012-13, their worst season in the Premier League when they finished 13th. Is there a sense, as many Stoke fans would suggest, that, you know, Mark Hughes has almost taken this team as far as they can go, despite, you know, some smart signings, despite a stronger squad perhaps than Stoke have ever had? There's almost a regression there for the Potters.
There is, and I think part of the reason for that is not in the same way as Arsenal, because I don't think Hughes has talked about it, but I think Stoke have very much become defined about finishing in the top half. So the second they drop out of that is seen as a massive regression. I think the problem is that even though they have spent money, they've put the likes of Mbula, Arnautovic has come in, even Shaqiri, they've brought these players that you think would elevate them to the next level, but actually it hasn't. It's kept them where they were, and then now it's actually seeing them creep down. So if I'm a Stoke fan, I'm frustrated, because just from a very basic macro perspective, you would assume more investment equals progression. And I think when it doesn't, that's when you question the person who's in charge of the players, in this case Mark Hughes, because I think possibly he has plateaued. I mean, he did very good things with Blackburn, but again, you have to wonder if that was the exception with him and not the rule, because he did really tank with Man City. I think just in general, he's someone that doesn't strike me as the most cuddly of managers, for want of a better adjective, in terms of, I don't imagine he puts his arm around Shaqiri and Arnautovic. I imagine it's very much you do things his way or the highway. And you now have concern if you're a Stoke fan, because you think, well, if we go out having now bought Berahino, who do we buy to massively improve us? Because you've got a fairly good team. I don't know if you've got a very efficient team.
It is an interesting situation, is Lawrence. I mean, we were talking a few weeks back about Premier League purgatory almost for Stoke, but yet when they sort of fall below their own standards they've set in recent years with Mark Hughes there, there is that dissent, there is that discontent. I mean, do you feel Mark Hughes has almost earned more time at the club, having secured those top half finishes? Or do you think now, as some Stoke fans seem to be suggesting, even though the club themselves have come out and backed Mark Hughes, that perhaps it is time for a change to sort of take them to another level?
Yeah, I don't always think it's as simple as whether you earn or don't earn. I think it's also a case of, a club can look to move on and look to move forward and say, you've taken us as far as I think you can take us. It's not always this endless growth. People have to plateau at some point. And as much as we'd like to show faith maybe in the likes of Mark Hughes, I think that there seems to be a sense of maybe just that he has taken the club as far as they can go. But at the same time, maybe the club has sort of imbued itself with this idea that they can't move any further, because a lot of people are very critical of the hierarchy there, how they don't seem to be embracing elements of Premier League life, to do with sponsorships, do with the global idea of the game. That's actually, there's something quite admirable within that, but you also have to realise the limitations of that within Premier League model, which is basically, if you don't embrace the New Balance model of a global launch, and you don't sort of manage to manage your social media correctly, then maybe you're not going to be the favourites of the fans, who will also criticise you for not being able to keep up with everyone else. Whoever's holding them back, I think people are going to be critical of them. And I think there's a feeling within the club that it's not only Mark Hughes that needs to change at this point, but there's a number of people who at least need to assess the way that the club's going.
Of course, there's other factors there, Dave. There's other influences. But, I mean, what do you make of Mark Hughes as manager? Because I've always felt he's had a very interesting career to go from Blackburn, where he's there for a number of years, to, although finishing in the bottom half of the table, to have, somewhat what was considered a degree of success, to go to Manchester City then, and their bigger budgets have not, things didn't quite work out from there. Same at QPR, where there was all sorts of different factors that played into what was a pretty disastrous spell. Now at Stoke for his fourth season, we're talking there about the conflict almost between consistency and being stagnant almost. As a manager, what's your view of Mark Hughes?
I think he's an interesting one. I think he's got a peak. He's got somewhere that, he's got a ceiling. He'll get to your club to a certain place of, pushing on the Europa League. But, the style of football, stylistically, there's nothing big. I don't think that in terms of the long-term development, he's a guy that you kind of want. He's kind of like Tony Pulis. Again, it's one of these things where you've got Tony Pulis at the club and he's so good. Why really move on from Tony Pulis when you're going to bring in someone like Mark Hughes? There isn't going to be a great deal of change there. The board's got a different way of signing different players, the likes of Shaqiri and Altovic, Bojan and so forth. But it just seems a bit weird, obviously, Bojan moving on, but and Altovic and Shaqiri being there and being like spare parts in a way. And I think you need a little bit more of a progressive manager to come out there and really show what they can do with these guys, maybe, or maybe go back to the old style of football. I think Mark Hughes is a little bit stuck in between of promising something great and then delivering something very average in a way.
Maybe Marco Silva, eh? Who knows?
Well,
right, that is the Premier League wrapped up then, guys. Before we go from this Monday podcast, any other business, guys? Anything interesting that you've seen this weekend? Anything else you want to talk about? It's been kind of a relaxed podcast tonight. I think, me and Chris being in the same room, him chilling on myself, there's been a different vibe tonight. I've enjoyed it. I will mention one thing, though. Dave, we're all together tonight. Obviously, Chris is down in London. Wonderful to see him. We were recording a little Periscope. We were doing a little vlog in there in the pub we were in. And you dropped a real bombshell on us.
Good bombshell.
The bleach hair is happening, but this is not going to be some cheap job that gets done. You are suggesting that we raise money for the bleach blonde bet and also for charity. That's what you're suggesting.
Yeah, I think it's a combination of both. Two things that I love in the world: bleach blonde hair, but of course, for charity, for a good charity. I think we'll set up a page for Mind Mental Health UK. So any of the excess money that goes above the you know, the cost of the bleach blonde haircut. Obviously, it's got to be done at a good place. It's going to be a year-long haircut or whatever, however long it takes to grow out. So, yeah, whatever the money that goes over.
A year?
I don't know.
Yeah, this for a year.
No, I don't know.
I'd have done it for about 3 months.
No, but I don't know what it's going to take. Yeah, you know, it could take 2 minutes, could take 5 minutes. I'm not sure, Adam. But anyway, yeah, if you, we'll set up a charity page. If you go and check out the Front 3 Twitter, and we'll link it there.
I will be contributing a significant amount to this cause. So, you know, I'm hoping to cover a lot of the... I almost feel guilty in a way, you know, where I've managed to escape a certain punishment.
Weird, isn't it? When, when guys, you've kind of lost the bet, but then you've actually won the bet.
Should it not be kind of like a knee charity or something that we should be set on the page for, you know, in honour of Zlatan? Is there not something we could do that's, you know, a tribute to the big
man? I think knees are important, but also I think your mental health is something that we do neglect in society that is a very important thing.
Knees or mental health, what's more important? It's the eternal question. But I think we will set up that page. And yeah, as I say, I'll make a significant contribution myself. But guys, if you want to contribute, it's all going to go to a good cause. Not just Dave's hair, which I think you'll agree is a very good cause, but also the choice, Dave's charity of choice. So beautiful. Excellent stuff. Guys, thank you so much for listening to this relaxed Monday podcast. It was relaxed, wasn't it, Chris? You're enjoying it over there on the sofa, aren't you?
I'm in shorts, of course. I'm relaxed.
He's in shorts, guys. Make of that what you will. Dave, until Thursday's Q&A podcast, where can the audience, where can the whole find more of you and your face and your
face and things at the Stat Monday Football Podcast? Make sure you go check that out. We'll be available
probably
at some point today.
It's the second best football podcast.
Yeah, I think the second best. Second best. Obviously behind the Football Ramble, right?
Yeah, something like that. Lawrence McKenna, he's been struggling with the signal tonight. He's had a little bit of dodgy signal, but he's struggled on valiantly. Where can the whole find more of you, Lawrence?
Certainly struggled on. At Lozcast. LOZCAST.
And just like that, ironically enough, you come through crystal clear. Chris Hennage, where can people find you apart from on the sofa of Adam Boltwood?
I'll be in New York by Thursday.
If people aren't in New York, could they find you on, I don't know, some sort of social media platforms or?
At the Front 3.
So selfless. I love it. Guys, you can follow me at Adam Boltwood and only at Adam Boltwood to find my incredibly intelligent musings and also to see a video from the pitch of White Hart Lane. It was great fun. I think I'm also going to be on Stephen Howson's show podcast thing, The Warm Down, for more Tottenham Manchester United analysis. Very exciting. I'm sure you'll agree. We'll be back on Thursday with the Q&A podcast. Until then, look out for some new videos.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
on the Front Free YouTube channel, and have a bloody great week.